So the ending of last week's lecture went like this. This was the last paragraph from last week's lecture. Wolfe, de Beauvoir, and Carter agree that women's lives are governed by a paradox of their situation. They belong at one and the same time to the male world and to a sphere in which that world is challenged. So I looked at how women's lives are kind of governed by this paradox of wanting to behave as patriarchy requires them to, but also knowing that their real self, if you like, what they really would like to do, does not belong in patriarchy. They're shut up in their world, surrounded by the other, and they can settle down nowhere in peace. And, of course, I've been saying this for 3 weeks. In 1967, this is precisely the situation that Carter depicts in the novel. It's a situation where women exist in a liminal space, in a space that of in-betweenness, a liminal space where the male world is all-powerful, but where there is room for challenge. That's why it's a paradox. They know that they can challenge, but they don't know how that challenge will happen. So what characteristics this challenge will take is what I'm going to explore today in this lecture on Sixu and Irigaray. So here's the plan for today. I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about context, and then I'm going to do close reading of the relevant sections from both Sixu and Irigaray. In 1968, so 1 year after the publication of this novel, political events that had started in France had spread as far as the US and Japan. 1968 was a turbulent year. It was a very significant political year. And this is where I'm going to show you some clips from YouTube, some history clips, just to give you an idea of the kind of controversies that were being explored. So I'm going to start with London. I'm going to skip on this. I think it's here. Oh, sorry. I hate security nonsense. Oh. Right, we're just going to watch it like this because I'm ignorant. 2, 3.
It started as an anti-Vietnam War demonstration in Trafalgar Square. About 10,000 gathered. Most of them were young. Most of them were sincere. They wanted peace. Their motives seemed honorable. They came from most walks of life. Vanessa Redgrave, as usual, was in the vanguard of the would-be peacemakers. And also there were troublemakers, people not content to just voice their disapproval of the war in Vietnam. A hardcore with intentions could drag the majority of well-intentioned demonstrators down to their sickening level. And so they marched through the sunny streets of London to Grosvenor Square and the American Embassy. Riot was being incited. At Grosvenor Square, police warned to expect trouble waiting. Their intention to keep the peace, prevent trouble. But at the head and in the midst of the advancing column, the hate makers were at work. This was how they turned their demonstration for peace into a bloody riot such as Britain has never before witnessed. Thank you. 17 policemen were injured while defending themselves and doing their duty. Only 45 demonstrators were hurt. The police have earned the highest possible praise for their incredible self-control against overwhelming brute force on a day when a demonstration for peace ended as a war in the heart of London.
That's not my message, by the way. Okay. One more clip. This is Paris in May 1968. It's a very long clip, so I'm just going to show you the bits that are relevant. Do you remember last week I told you that it was a student protest in Paris? So it wasn't against the Vietnam War. So this is a different context. It was a student protest, and the reason it started is because they decided to raise tuitions and to exclude specifically poor students from the university. So this is why it started. Get out of here.
Okay. La Sorbonne, quant à elle, est toujours bien gardée. À 18h30, il y a 30 000 manifestants place d'Enfer Rochefort. Les étudiants se sont joints des lycéens. Le dispositif, cependant, est renforcé à la Sorbonne. Des milliers de policiers cadrillent systématiquement les alentours. À l'enfer, un mot d'ordre a été lancé. Occupez le quartier latin. Les manifestants sont décidés à ne pas céder le terrain avant d'avoir obtenu satisfaction. Des négociations commencent et dans la nuit, la tension atteint son point culminant. Barricades brûlent. Derrière chacune d'elles, les étudiants résistent avec tout l'acharnement de leur jeunesse et de leur conviction. C'est une véritable bataille qui va durer 4 heures. Les grenades lacrymogènes, dont on parlera longtemps, explosent. Et tout au long de la nuit, les secours aux blessés causeront un grave problème.
Ok, I'm stopping that one. And then the last clip I want to show you is California 1968.
Behind scenes reminiscent of war-torn cities. More than 100 square blocks were decimated by fire and looters, and few buildings were left intact. Firemen were harassed by snipers and brick-throwing hoodlums as they attempted to control the fires, many of which were left to burn themselves out. As the National Guard moved in to restore comparative calm, the losses by fire alone were put at $200 million. No attempt has yet been made to estimate the losses suffered at the hands of the looters, who stole everything from liquor to playpens. Firemen were later issued black suits of bulletproof mesh to protect them from snipers who continued to shoot from rooftops. Nearly 3,000 were arrested. And authorities had to open abandoned jails to house those netted by the police. It took the appearance of 14,000 troops to bring an end to what both Negro and white leaders called insurrection by hoodlums. Civil rights leaders were quick to deplore the unbridled lawlessness, and Martin Luther King vowed to do all in his power to prevent a recurrence in Los Angeles or anywhere. Calm prevails in what is known as the Watts area of the city. a curfew was put into effect, and the entire section declared off limits to all but residents. The people who live here are suffering great hardship with no grocery, drug, or other service stores able to operate. A special task force of 1,000 policemen stays on the alert as the thousands of guardsmen patrol an area of 35 square miles. The outbreak spread to other Southern California cities.
So you get an idea of what was going on in 1968. I've shown you three different types of riots. I've shown you the Vietnam protests in London. I've shown you the student protests in Paris. And I've shown you these race riots, which in fact came just a few weeks before the assassination of Martin Luther King in April 1968. And obviously, we don't have time, and it's not a history lesson for us to go in detail into what was really going on in 1968 all over the world. But this was the mood. It was the mood that we need things to change. We are not happy with these authorities dictating to us who we fight, who we don't fight, what kind of racial attitudes we have to have, what kind of gendered attitudes we have to have. So there was discontent with class distinctions, race distinctions, and certainly with the war. And that's really the mood within which Carter's later fiction was written. And so I want to think about this context of anything is possible if the underdog, the underclasses, can rebel, which is really what I want to get out of these videos. And I hope if you have a chance to discuss them in the seminars, you really note how the rhetoric of the narrators is always on the side of the police. The police are there to enforce the law, and these revolutionary people are creating chaos. That rhetoric is what we want, is what Carter's rebelling against. That rhetoric is what Csikszentmihalyi and Irigaray wanted to challenge. Okay, so the reading for this week comes to us from these two French critics, Csikszentmihalyi and Irigaray, and I'm going to discuss them simultaneously because their ideas are similar on many points. And then I'm going to offer a critique and assessment of their essays. In order to understand really the difference between Csikszentmihalyi and Irigaray and de Beauvoir and Woolf, there are two key terms that you need to know. Equality feminism and difference feminism. Equality feminists are, they don't have to be women, yeah? They are writers who share the belief that women should be able to participate equally in society and should have equal access to the benefits and positions that society makes available. So I'm going to repeat that. Equality feminists share the belief that women should be able to participate equally in society and should have equal access to the benefits and positions that society makes available. Some equality feminists want women to be able to participate equally in the existing social institutions. Okay? So participate equally in existing social institutions. While other equality feminists think that society needs to be radically transformed before equality can become possible. Okay? Difference feminists start from a different set of concerns. Difference feminists are not looking at what we have already and saying, oh, we want to participate equally in it. They start from a different set of concerns. They believe that women have distinctive values, distinctive perspectives. The worth and importance of which have not been recognized. Difference feminists reject the view that women, above all, need equal access to the public sphere as it is presently arranged. I don't agree with that. Presently, difference feminists would argue, the public sphere is shaped by masculine values. But these are not the only legitimate values. Do you see the difference between the two? Yeah? Okay, so Cixous and Irigaray are difference feminists. They want to challenge the bases upon which society and culture are constructed before they can think of participating in society or culture. Last week, I mentioned briefly de Beauvoir's famous statement, "One is not born a woman, one becomes it." And I said that it represents her understanding of femininity as based not on essence, but on experience. Well, this statement is a good starting point for understanding Cixous. Consider this statement: one is not born a woman, one becomes it through experience. Very well. What if the experience that one has of the world around her is predicated, is based on binary opposites that place woman as the passive, the inferior, the silent other? What kind of woman does one become then? And this is the very first question that is posed by Cixous in the extract from Sortie that we had to read for today. She calls binary opposites, this is her own term, dual hierarchized positions. Because she maintains that when culture juxtaposes father, mother, head, heart, day, night, there is an implicit privileging of the one over the other. There's a hierarchy built in to these oppositions. And this hierarchy, Cixous would say, has historical and cultural origins. It has no other basis. The hierarchy that is inherent in these dichotomies, in these binaries, has no biological origin, it has no logical origin, it has historical and cultural origins. It's just society that has created the hierarchy that is inherent in these binaries. So the way in which our culture reads hierarchized oppositions privileges the man, not necessarily the male, but the position of masculinity. And I explained this last week. Do you remember that the position of masculinity and the position of femininity can be occupied by either gender? So the way in which our culture reads hierarchized oppositions privileges the man over the woman. So if one becomes it, and it is the position of woman, then in this structure, one can only become passive, inferior, silent, other. Does that make sense? Great. And so Cixous maintains that the consequence of the subordination of the feminine, which is her expression, the consequence of that is the exclusion of the woman from participation in history and culture. That makes sense. If the only position you occupy is that of silent other, and history is written by the dominant category, then by being excluded from the dominant category, you are not writing your history. You are not writing your life. And therefore, history is written then only with narratives about the dominant forces. And this is what Cixous means when she says that in the extreme, the world of being, and in French she uses the verb to be, être, the world of being, existing, can function to the exclusion of the mother. That's what she means by that. Because the exclusion of the mother, she means that the position of femininity, that's what she means by it. So there is no need then for the mother. You wouldn't need that position of the mother, provided that the father can fill in this role. That's what she argues. In these binary oppositions that inform our thinking, Cixous says, either woman is passive or she doesn't exist because of the hierarchy inherent in those binaries. And here, Cixous invokes the example of literary history, which, of course, is a concern that she shares with Virginia Woolf. So she invokes the example of literary history, where she notes that in literary history, the subordination of the feminine to the masculine order appears to be the condition of the functioning of the machine. I've just explained what that means. You get it now, yeah? Great. And again here, I must emphasize that the terms masculine and feminine, as used by Cixous, do not refer to men and women. You can read them to refer to racial identities. You can read them to refer to class identities. These are subject positions that members of either gender could potentially occupy. And Cixous clarifies this point. This is not my interpretation. She clarifies this point when she explains that she is using qualifiers of sexual difference. For there are men who do not repress their femininity, women who more or less inscribe their masculinity. The difference is not distributed according to socially determined sexes. That's what she means by that. She's saying that masculine and feminine are not necessarily gendered positions. They are subject positions. The argument then is that society subordinates the feminine and privileges the masculine. And we can note how the concerns in Carter's novel anticipate Cixous' arguments. Be very careful. Magic Toy Shop does not know of Cixous and Irigaray yet. The concerns there anticipate what Cixous and Irigaray will later say. And now I'm going to do some close reading of the novel based on these ideas. I'm sure you noticed that mothers are physically absent in this novel. So last week I talked about Uncle Philip. The previous week I talked about the novel and the genre. Today I'm thinking about mothers. Melanie's mother is written out of the narrative within the first few pages. Mrs. Rundell, the substitute mother figure, is separated from the children. And Aunt Margaret, we know that her mother died. We don't know how she died. And Aunt Margaret herself, who's been married to Uncle Philip for a few years, is childless. So mothers are physically absent. There is, I would argue, not an empty space where the mother should be, but an abyss. An abyss where the mother should be. And by looking at the representation of mother figures in this novel, we can try and examine why that is. We learn about the mother through Melanie's memories of her. Melanie remembers her mother exactly as Cixous would expect. She remembers her mother through the lens of history and culture. The absence of the mother invites Melanie to try and reconstruct her mother's body, her mother's history, by accessing her body through memory. Shall I say that again? So the absence of Melanie's mother encourages her to reconstruct the mother's history by accessing her body through memory. And here is the scene where that happens. This is a quote from the novel. Melanie tried to imagine her parents making love. She tried to imagine their embraces in this bed, but her mother always seemed to be wearing her black going-to-town suit. Her mother, in particular, was an emphatically clothed woman, clothed all over, never without stockings, whatever the weather, always gloved and hatted, ready for some outing. Her mother must have been born dressed, perhaps in an elegant, well-fitting cowl, selected from a feature in a glossy magazine what the well-dressed embryo is wearing this year. You can see in this passage that the mother's body is inaccessible to Melanie. Her mother seems to have been born dressed. Because Melanie can only see her mother in her social context, that's her social persona, the dress going to town suit persona. Because Melanie can only see her mother in the social context, she does not know her mother's body. She knows the clothed, socially conditioned body. But there is a hint in this quotation as to how we can read this female body. Look at this quote. Does the statement, what the well-dressed embryo is wearing this year, make sense? This is supposedly a quote that Melanie reads in a glossy magazine. Why is there a mention of an embryo? Well, the key to that is in a previous word, call. Do you see it here? Call. Carter here is using call in its two meanings. And here are the meanings. A call is a part, is a covering of network for the head worn by women, like a net that you wear on your hair. But a call is also a part of the amnion, one of the membranes enveloping the fetus, which sometimes is round the head of a child at birth. Sometimes it's also called a veil. So the call is a net that covers women's hair, and it is the membrane that envelops a fetus. So you can see the irony that Carter shares with us as readers. Now, Melanie is not aware of what she's saying. We're analyzing how Melanie remembers her mother. And she remembers her through what has been written in these glossy magazines. But the use of the word call is really symptomatic of how little Melanie knew her mother, and also of how Carter is representing this mother in her social context. Melanie's mother is enveloped like a fetus in her socially conditioned role. Now, the second moment in the narrative where Melanie tries to recover her mother's body is where she turns to her mother's wedding photograph. And here, too, she notices her mother's clothing. She notices that on her wedding day, her mother had an epiphany of clothing, as she says. Her father, too, always seemed clothed. Always seemed to be wearing the same clothes, she tells us. In her wedding photo, mother and father are posing next to other relatives. And here's what Melanie notices. Unlike the rest, Uncle Philip did not smile to the camera. He might have strayed into the picture from another group. His expression was quite blank. Too blank, even. Well, it is significant that Uncle Philip seemed to come from another group. He is the antithesis in this photograph. He is the binary opposite to the mother. And in this case, he's also the opposite to the father and the father's family. Because remember that he is the mother's only surviving relative who comes to that wedding and who is in the photo. The photo then seems to suggest two groups. Those who are smiling and those whose faces are blank. If we hold this photograph in our mind, then my reading of Uncle Philip from last week's lecture, I hope, makes more sense. Remember how I read him in opposition to the father? He occupies the masculine sphere, and mum and dad occupy this feminine, silent sphere. Now, Cixous tells us that the bodily encounter with the mother allows sons and daughters to develop their sexualities. Of course, she borrows this from Freud, right? Which she does. So she tells us that the bodily encounter with the mother allows sons and daughters to develop their sexualities. The girl who aims to differentiate herself from the mother, and the boy who desires the mother's body. Well, if the mother's body is inaccessible, then Cixous would argue that the young girl, Melanie in this case, lacks access to sexual difference because she needs access to the mother's body to identify herself as a sexual being. She needs to differentiate herself from the mother. But the mother's body is not there. It's inaccessible. And therefore, Melanie lacks access to feminine sexual pleasure. The suppression of the mother leads the daughter to seek an understanding of her sexuality in the models available to her in society. And these models, Cixous argues, are phallocentric. If you open any glossy magazine, the options available to you as a young girl are very scary indeed nowadays. I think most of the pictures come signed with the doctor who enhanced them. The Mrs. Rundles of the world are archetypes of femininity. They are coded mannequins. The Mrs. Rundles, these traditional mother-like figures, are coded mannequins who have only ever experienced sexuality from one perspective. And Irigaray would agree with this reading. She calls the relationship with the mother a dark continent. And this is why I said that there's an abyss in this novel. There's an inaccessible kind of empty space. Irigaray calls the relationship with the mother a dark continent. It remains in the shadows of our culture. Irigaray sees woman occupying two spaces. The first space is one that satisfies the social and material roles that are prescribed to her. For example, the woman has to have children. She's expected to care for others. She's expected to be a reproducer of labor force. She has to have children because these children are going to be the workers in society. So Irigaray acknowledges that there is that space that women occupy, the socially expected space. But the other role of woman is that of the imaginary and symbolic, which is about the mother's relationship with the son or daughter. Irigaray, like Cixous, finds that the social and material roles, do you know what material roles are? The roles that you can ascribe amount of time to or money to, the material, the concrete roles in society. So she finds that the social and material roles of women are easily recognizable because we can see women performing these material roles. But the imaginary and symbolic role is repressed. Both critics, both Irigaray and Cixous, argue that they are writing at a time in history which is a transitional time. It's a period... It is, and this is a quote, it's a period when this question of domination by fathers can no longer be avoided. And this is a similar quote to the one I showed you from Carter in 1968, where she was saying this was a time when we were really considering our existence. So Irigaray says, the social order, our culture wanted this way. The mother must remain forbidden and excluded. The father forbids the bodily encounter with the mother. So how do we then access the imaginary and the symbolic? Well, Irigaray says that we have to go back to the very first bodily encounter with the mother. The very first bodily encounter with the mother in intrauterine life, in the relationship with the placenta, the first house that surrounds us, whose halo we carry with us everywhere, like some child's security blanket. Well, going back to Melanie, we see Melanie attempting to conjure up her mother's body. Then the statement that her mother was born dressed, perhaps in an elegant, well-fitting caul. You see the links to the placenta, to the intrauterine life. That's what Melanie is obviously unconsciously trying to get to. Like, how do I relate to my mother? What do we have in common? What access do I have to her? So you see how the two link together. Irigaray is trying to tell us that our link with the symbolic relationship with the mother happens in a realm that is not material, that is imaginary, that is not symbolized by our language or patriarchal culture, that goes beyond the symbolic. So the technical word she uses is semiotic, which is not in this essay. But that's what she's trying to get to. That there's concrete access you can have to the mother's body. You look at her, if you're a girl, and you say, oh my God, I'm going to have my mother's hips when I grow up. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I've got to go to the gym. And if you're a boy, you think, oh, you know, this is my beautiful mom. She smells lovely. I think that's what boys say. I don't know. And whatever. So you've got this like concrete relationship to your mom. But that is not enough, because if your mom looks like what society wants her to look, then that's not a real relationship with your mom. Do you understand? If my mom is Jordan, and I'm looking at her thinking, right, a couple of years from now, you know, the whole thing's going to change, that relationship with my mom is mediated by society. It's not real. And that's what Irigaray is trying to get to. That material relationship with your mom is conditioned by society. She's trying to access an unmediated relationship with the mom that happens at a level that is beyond the symbolic. So it goes back to the one unmediated relationship with her, which is the intrauterine, as she calls it, relationship. Society has not yet gone in there, you know, and told you as a fetus how to grow up. So that's the one still sacred relationship, we hope. Do you get it now? Do you get why the reference to the call is interesting? Okay. So Melanie is trying to access not the mother's role as it is represented in the wedding photo, but she's trying to think about the well-fitting call, the part of the body that is shared exclusively between mother and child. So think of Aunt Margaret. She and her brothers are motherless. She cares for her brothers in the house of her husband, Uncle Philip. They are a family. He is the father figure, and she is the mother figure. That's how that weird family is constructed. The father forbids the bodily encounter with the mother. Margaret's body occupies that mother's space, and in that respect, she must remain forbidden, excluded. Now, Irigaray says that when the father forbids the mother her generative powers because he wants to be the sole creator, he superimposes upon her body a set of signs and symbols which rob her of her identity. I'll explain that. She's saying that when the father interferes with even the reproductive powers of the mother, then he is stopping even her biological kind of function, as Uncle Philip does to Aunt Margaret. And by doing that, he imposes on her a set of signs and symbols. In this case, the archetype of the silent, Griselda-like woman, which is what Aunt Margaret is reduced to, which rob her of her identity. Okay. In Carter's novel, Uncle Philip sees himself as the only creator, the father. And Aunt Margaret has no creative space to express herself except for playing music secretly with her brothers. Uncle Philip's oppression has superimposed on her body a set of signs. We see her being frail. We see her inability to speak, which rob her of her identity. So in order for Aunt Margaret to transcend this oppressive situation of being desubjectivized, the rule of the father must be challenged. So Irigaray contends that the murder of the father must take place. Obviously, it's metaphorical. Murder here is used to signify a desire to take his place. I think it's a quote that I have. Yes. So the murder of the father here signifies a desire to take his place, a rival and competitive desire, but a desire to do away with the one who artificially cut the link with the mother in order to take over the creative power of all worlds, especially the female world. Well, Irigaray imagines the woman committing the murder of the father and taking over the creative power of the female world, and she calls this rebirth. Carter's novel, in many ways, anticipates this reading. In Carter's novel, the position of woman is occupied by Aunt Margaret and her two brothers. Is that right? Do you agree? Everybody who's disempowered by Uncle Philip is occupying that subordinate position. So the murder of the father begins with Francie's desire to take his place. Do you remember that he sat in Uncle Philip's seat at the table? Near the end of the novel, he sits in his chair. Do you remember that he wore one of Uncle Philip's shirts as well? And do you remember that he made the decision not to open the shop for the first time? Francie's desire for Margaret rivals and is a competitive desire to Uncle Philip's. Francie and Finn burn the house and decide to literally kill Uncle Philip because he cut the link with the mother. He interrupts the bodily encounter with the mother. Now, why is this an important reading of the novel? Well, it's important for two reasons. Firstly, this reading of the novel offers an insight into Melanie's attitude towards sexuality because of her lack of access to her mother's body, and illustrates her lack of access to a genealogy of women. There's no grandmother, there's no mother, there's no daughter. Melanie cannot see herself as part of a female tradition. She's just there. She's just Melanie. She doesn't even see a link to her younger sister. She doesn't have an opportunity to mother her younger sister. So she just exists there. That's the liminal space. Irigaray advocates the practice of locating ourselves. And this is for men and women. This also applies to race, to class. She wants us to locate ourselves within a genealogy of women so as to conquer and keep our identity. When you look at yourself and you say, where do I come from and where am I going? You need to see people who look like you to know where you came from and where you're going. Can you see how this applies also to race and class identities? Secondly, this reading shows Aunt Margaret's body, shows how Aunt Margaret's body symbolically represents the oppressed and silent mother's body, which must be accessed and liberated. Because that's really what the burning of the house allows. It allows access to this silent and oppressed body. Okay, almost done. Cixous's essay ends on a note of hope that the categories of femininity and masculinity would someday not amount to the same thing. This is something that we will explore in depth next week. So she says, I hope that the categories of masculinity and femininity will not amount to the same thing. That's difference feminism. Her logic supports a version of sexual difference which accommodates bisexuality as a necessary practice in order for each individual to experience jouissance. Yeah, and jouissance is sexual pleasure. With the opposite sex, but also with the same sex. That's what she is gesturing towards, and that's something we're going to explore next week. Bisexuality is Cixous' solution. That's what she says. Admitting the component of the other sex makes men and women at once much richer, plural, and strong. At this point, I want to take a moment to think critically of the theories that I've just presented. I ask, what are the implications of these theories? And I realize that Cixous and Irigaray are more theoretical than pragmatic. So I ask myself, how can these theories be useful to me as a literary critic, as a reader of literary texts? Well, the question that both theorists pose seems to revolve around the body. Can the body be a source, the source of a new discourse? A discourse that is not necessarily mediated by the laws of patriarchal society. And you know, going back to the YouTube scenes I showed you before, and when I asked you to think about the discourse that the narrators are using, which really shows a contrast to what's happening in the actual clip, that's precisely what Irigaray wants you to think about. Just by looking at those bodies in that film and what they're doing and how they're being beaten up helplessly, unarmed people protesting for what they think is right, being beaten up by police officers, what those bodies are doing and what you're hearing as a narrative doesn't coincide. And Cixous is asking, can we generate a new discourse that is based on what the body says, not on what has been traditionally received? Do you get it? Okay. So can the body be the source of a new discourse, a discourse that is not necessarily mediated by the laws of patriarchal society? Conventional narrative techniques, conventional ways of writing, grammar, syntax, all of those rules about how to write, imply the unified viewpoint and mastery of outer reality that the position of man has claimed for himself, for itself. And so these theories advocate a transformation of the literary modes and language on the one hand. Let us not write simply by mimicking the way literature has been written before. But they also advocate the broadening of the context of women's discourses on the other. That's it for me. See you next week. Thank you.